The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. I'm Morris Williams, and it's my privilege to welcome you to another wonderful event. But I think that the real jewel of the Free Library of Philadelphia are the 54 branches located throughout the city that provide wonderful services to all of our citizens, but particularly focused on our young people. So I hope as you think about your year-end gifts, that you'll think about making a gift to the Free Library of Philadelphia, targeting the branches and the youth empowerment programs that exist throughout all of our 54 branches. If you haven't read or gotten a copy of David Rubenstein's new book, How to Invest, I encourage you to do so. It's a wonderful collection of 23 interviews that he's done with investors across a great variety of subjects. And so you'll have an opportunity to gain insights into many different aspects. It's not just about stocks and bonds, but it's also about investing philosophy, and I think it's well worth your attention. David Rubenstein, as you I'm sure already know, is a world-famous investor. He, in 1987, co-founded the Carlyle Private Equity Firm. That firm today manages $369 billion, plus or minus what is happening in the markets, 29 offices and five continents. So quite a transformation in the past 35 years. But David has also been a wonderful citizen of America with his focus on collecting American history and making on display to encourage us to understand our history and the importance of the interaction of history from the past, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and what is going on today in terms of our lives. David serves on many boards. I got to know him when he was chair of the board at Duke University. He's also the chair of the Smithsonian Institute, which is obviously an extremely important civic institution. And I would also highlight the fact that David, among his many honors, is the recipient of the Carnegie Medal of Philanthropy. Tonight, David is going to be interviewed by our own Philadelphia citizen, Richard Vague. Richard, for the last 2 years, has been serving as the Secretary of Banking and Securities for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and he serves on both of the pension boards, both for the state teachers and for the state employees. He also is a successful businessman and an author, and I would encourage one of his books, The Illustrated Business History of the United States, as another book that you might want to pick up because it's quite insightful. But let me step aside. Let's give a warm Philadelphia welcome to David Rubenstein and Richard Vague.
Great to see everyone, and it's really an honor to have David Rubenstein here with us. And I'd like to say thanks to Morris for being our MC and for saying such kind words about both of us as we came out. David, kudos. This book is not only wonderful instruction for how to invest, it's a marvelous history of investing over the last 50 or so years. How certain types of investing originated and what their purpose and objectives are. So much so, I would recommend it as a must-read for any serious investor. You profile and interview 23 investors in this book. All are investment superstars who help develop the products and approaches that define the investment world today. Reading your book, I would note that a lot of these folks are out and out contrarians. Do you have to be a contrarian to make outside investment returns?
Well, first let me say I appreciate everybody's coming, and I'm honored to be at the Free Library of Philadelphia. I love the word free because when you have books, you know, very often people can't afford to buy them. So libraries are wonderful. I grew up in Baltimore, and there was the Enoch Pratt Free Library. My parents really couldn't afford to buy books for me when I was young, so I got a lot of free books to read out of the Enoch Pratt Library. I think libraries are indispensable to a good free society, and I appreciate all of your support of this library. Answer your question. If you go along and invest with what everybody does, by definition, you'll be in the medium. You'll be in the middle. You'll be basically the average. And so if you're going to be great at something, you have to take a risk. You have to do something other people don't do. And generally, one of the qualities that the investors had in common, they're great investors, were that they were willing to defy conventional wisdom or not to take the path of least resistance. So that's what made these people very well known. They were able to do something nobody else saw at the time. And so I think it's very helpful. It's one of the qualities that I did identify in these investors.
Well, let's take that a little further. You highlight the defining characteristics of each of these individuals, but perhaps in addition to being a contrarian, what do you view as one or two of the most important characteristics for a great investor to have?
I think, I don't know if I can limit the two, but the characteristics that I think are important are, one, be reasonably intelligent. All of them are pretty intelligent people. They're generally well-educated. They don't tend to be people who dropped out of high school. They generally tend to be pretty well-educated. They have a pretty good facility for numbers. They don't have to be mathematicians, but a pretty good facility for numbers. They are willing to admit a mistake and go on to the next thing. I often linger with my mistakes for 30 or 40 years. They go on to the next thing. They also are really good at sharing the credit and also taking the blame. They're also pretty good at making the final decision. They don't really want to delegate a great investment decision. They want to make that decision themselves, and they'll take the blame if it doesn't work out. They also tend to be people who are, I'd say, incredible readers. Great investors don't just read about their area of expertise. They read everything. They want to know as much knowledge as they can about everything, because they never know what piece of knowledge that you have from reading a book or reading something will come back and help you in the investment area. So they're incredibly committed to reading, which I think is a very important skill. And so those are some of the things they think that are important to being a really good investor.
They're great for being a great investor, and I think they're probably great for being a great person as well. So one of your subjects is Betsy Cohen, who, of course, is one of our heroes here in Philadelphia. Your discussion with her is largely about SPACs, which were in vogue during the pandemic, but, as you point out, have fallen from favor. Yet Betsy continues to have success. How does she continue to succeed where the others have fallen?
For those who are not investment aficionados, a SPAC stands for Special Purpose Acquisition Company. And what that really means is that normally if you have a company and you want to take it public, it's a process that could take 6 months to 9 months or maybe even a year, going through the SEC and so forth and getting a prospectus that describes everything that could go wrong and so forth. What SPACs do is they say to a company, you don't have to go through the SEC process. We have a company that the SEC has already approved. It doesn't have any assets, doesn't have anything. We're going to use this kind of company that's a virtual company, has no real assets or other than money that was put into it, doesn't own anything. We're going to use that to buy your company. And therefore, your company, because we're public, will become public right away. And you save money, you save time, and so forth. And for a while, people were enamored with it because it was a cheaper way to go public, a quicker way to go public. And people were able to get a big kick on the stock as soon as they went public. The theory was a stock would bounce up 10 or 15%, and you could sell your stock right into the market. Unfortunately, a lot of due diligence wasn't done on some of these companies, and people were taking SPACs, companies public and through SPACs that were not appropriate for public companies, and they went down. So I think 95% of the SPACs in the last couple of years are under their offering price. Betsy Cohen's have done pretty well. Betsy Cohen, for those who don't know, is a graduate of University of Pennsylvania Law School. She taught at the law school for a while with her husband. She's an entrepreneur based in Philadelphia for a long part of her career. and she specialized in financial service companies, so that she really knew what she was doing. She wouldn't say, I'll do a SPAC here or SPAC there. She just tended to do financial service companies, and she knew what she was doing. So her companies have held up pretty well, but even she would say it's very difficult to do today.
So Jim Simons is another of your subjects, a math genius who's made a fortune in quantitative investing. I loved how when you complimented him by noting his returns were 40%+ annually, he quickly corrected you by saying higher than that,
right,
higher than 40%. My favorite anecdote from your interview with Jim is when, at a point where he was young, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Maxwell Taylor, who was head of the organization where Jim worked, wrote a cover story in the New York Times Magazine on how well the U.S. was doing in the Vietnam War. Jim immediately dashed off a letter to the editor saying that the Vietnam War was, quote, the dumbest thing we could ever have done, and we should get out of there as soon as possible. As you might guess, he didn't stay there long. Can you tell us more about Jim, and how common is it for other investing superstars to take such contrary positions?
Yeah. Let me try to explain to you what he does. Jim Simons is not good in math. He's a world-class mathematician, one of the best mathematicians in the world at the time, and came up with some theorems that I could not explain, but they're still used. He went to MIT, got his PhD at Berkeley, and then became the head of the math department at State University of New York in Long Island for at the age of 30. And he ultimately drifted into something called quantitative investing, which is what he more or less invented. Quantitative investing means this. It's generally been thought that the human brain is probably the best thing to figure out how to make an investment. But he came up with the idea that you could use math theories and math algorithms to figure out how you could find an inefficiency in a market. So let's suppose a Bitcoin is trading for 5 cents a Bitcoin in Paraguay, but it's trading for 10 cents a Bitcoin in Russia. Well, by figuring out that there's a disparity there, he could go in and buy the cheaper ones in Paraguay and then maybe sell them to somebody in Russia. So looking for market inefficiencies is what he came up with the idea of doing, but doing it by using high-speed computers and having mathematicians program these computers and looking for market inefficiencies. It's now called quantitative investing. Essentially, you're using math to kind of look for market inefficiencies. And as he said, he's basically done better than 40% a year for 30 years. That's pretty good, 40% a year for 30 years. And so he's eccentric. Sometimes geniuses are eccentric. He's a genius. Two of his eccentricities I'm not sure I subscribe to. He smokes 2 packs of cigarettes a day and has for the last 50, 60 years. He's 82 or 3 now. He gets checked up every so often, and amazingly, he hasn't had lung cancer. I don't know how. He brings his own ashtray to meetings because he's smoking so much. He tries not to smoke in your face, but he does smoke. Secondly, he doesn't believe in socks. Now, Albert Einstein never wore socks either, but one time, and Albert Einstein's theory was the big toe would eventually force a hole in the sock, so why wait for that hole to show up? Just get not wear socks. So Albert Einstein never had socks. Jim Simons' theory is, I think it's an unnecessary adornment as well. So one time I interviewed him at an Albert Einstein event. He was getting an award named after Albert Einstein, and he showed up in black tie with no socks. So I've thought about not wearing socks from time to time at events like this and see whether I could do better as an investment professional, but I decided not to do that.
You can take them off now if you want to. We're not going to... Another favorite takeaway from the interview with Jim is where you credit him for trading for profits, where, as you were just pointing out to us, there's a market anomaly, and continue to do so until that anomaly goes away. He quickly responds to you by saying, quote, sometimes those anomalies last for a very long time. Sometimes they never go away. David, how's it possible in our supposedly efficient markets that some anomalies never go away?
Well, sometimes markets are not as efficient as you would like, but I think he was really saying anomaly could last for not a nanosecond, but maybe a day or two or three or maybe even a month. Sometimes it could last longer, but generally today, the markets are pretty efficient, and therefore it's unlikely that you're going to have an anomaly that nobody's going to know about, and so forth. But you know what he may have meant there is that sometimes people, like for example today, the general consensus is probably that the treasury bills are a good thing to buy today because interest rates are higher, and therefore people are going to keep buying it. But maybe it will continue to be a good buy for quite some time. But eventually there'll be an anomaly where somebody is shorting the bonds, and eventually that probably will work out. But I think as a general rule of thumb, though, quantitative investing is not for everybody. In fact, I try to point out in the book, I've interviewed these people. You have 23. Actually, I interviewed many more people than that. And then the publisher ultimately said there's only room for 23. So I had to, I didn't know what to do. I'm going to call my friends back, who's famous investors, and say, you know, you didn't make it in the book. It's hard to do that. And they wanted to make sure I didn't have only white males in the book. So I had a fair amount of diversity, and I said, well, this famous white male hedge fund guy is going to be really upset if he's not in the book. So I didn't know what to do. So I came up with the idea of putting a number of them in the audio version of the book. So if you, in the audio version, we actually have the real tapes of the interviews. And so a lot of them made it that way. But, you know, I'd say investors are people who, in my view, are doing something useful for society. And that's just an important point I wanted to convey, just to interrupt the questioning for a moment. Generally, people that invest are thought to be people are interested in making money, and maybe they're greedy, and maybe they use their money for not great purposes. Maybe they don't all give it away. But the truth is that if you're really good at allocating capital, you can do a good thing for society. So, for example, there's a firm in Boston, Flagship Ventures, which put up the initial money and stayed with them for 10 years to a company called Moderna. Moderna came up with a vaccine that many of us have probably benefited from. Suppose that venture capital firm hadn't stayed with Moderna, you know, they would have maybe not been criticized by their investors, but they were willing to take the criticism because they really thought Moderna was going to do something useful. And so if you have really good investors and you allocate capital appropriately, you can create great companies, save great companies, and do good things for society. And so I don't really think, and I tried, I just spoke at Wharton a few hours ago, and I tried to tell young people there, you know, being an investor is not just a matter of making money and being greedy. It's a matter of trying to do something good for society by allocating capital in a good way and ultimately, hopefully, produce good companies for it.
So Bruce Karsh of Oaktree is another of your subjects. You picked him because he pioneered investing in distressed debt and succeeded wildly. Now, in a business that is by definition adversarial, where you expect investors to be sharp-elbowed and tough, I love how he says, quote, I never yelled. My mode has been to be friendly and try to forge relationships, end quote. How does he combine those two things? Okay. How does he pull off being adversarial and friendly?
For those who don't know what distressed debt investing is, to make it simple, let's suppose I'm going to do a buyout of a company for $100, and I put on $50 equity, and I need to borrow $50. In the old days, I would probably put in $1 and borrow $99. But let's say today it's $50, and then I'm going to borrow $50. And let's suppose if the company goes bankrupt, the assets, the physical assets, are worth $30, so that the banks can say, I'm going to go through bankruptcy, but I know the assets are worth $30. So the banks are going to lend you $30, saying, I know it's hard assets, it's money good, it's a senior loan. But there's $20 left. Well, that $20 I need, I have $50 of equity, borrowed $30 from the banks, I need $20. It's called junk bonds, high yield bonds, whatever you want to call them. But that's subordinate, it's not as secure. So what you do is, if a company goes and you do a buyout and you pay $100, let's suppose the company isn't doing well. All of a sudden, the debt will trade below the value that it was issued at. So if the debt was 30 cents, if you had $30 of debt, because it's senior debt and the assets are still worth $30, it might be trading at par, $30. But the so-called high-yield debt or junk bond debt might be trading at $10 or even $5 or zero almost practically. So that means it's worth very little. So if you're a distressed debt investor, you might say, I think this company will either go bankrupt and some of the distressed debt will get equity in the new company and it'll be worth a lot more, or eventually the company's going to turn around and that what I'm buying today for $2 is really going to be worth $20. So Bruce Karsh is a person who started Oaktree, which is one of the leading distressed debt investors. And the person who's best known there is a guy named Howard Marks, who's on TV a lot. He's written a lot of good books. Bruce is a friend of mine, but he's never done an interview before. His first interview he ever did, because he's shy. He actually does the investing, and Howard does all the, you know, the media and talking. But the reason Bruce is able to get away with it is because he typically is buying senior debt that is at distressed prices. And when you're in a bankruptcy setting, the senior debt can pretty much set the terms. And he doesn't like to litigate. So he's done very well. They've averaged, 18% a year for the last 30 years or so. That's pretty good.
Bruce says that when people ask him for career advice, he warns them away from distressed debt, quote, because it is highly cyclical and there are extended times when you just have to be patient, try not to do stupid things, sit on your hands, and that's not easy for everybody. But David, isn't that cyclicality true for all investing? Shouldn't almost every investor be prepared to sit on the sidelines for a while?
Well, sure. You know, if you are a day trader and you feel you got to trade every day, then you don't sit on the sidelines. But really good investors have patience. One of the best investors I talked to in the book is a guy named Seth Klarman, who built the firm called Baupost, very good hedge fund. Sometimes he hasn't made any major investments for a year or so because he thinks that he is a value investor. Value investors are people that want to buy something that's worth a dollar for 50 cents. And they like, or what Warren Buffett would call cigar butts. Butts that are on the ground, nobody wants them. You pick them up and they're worth something later on. So if you are a value investor like Seth Klarman, and prices are high as they were for a couple years before the tech bubble burst, you'd have nothing to buy because everything was expensive. Now people like that who are distressed debt investors are going to find a lot of things because there's going to be a lot of distressed debt going forward. So I'll give you an example of a distressed debt everybody can probably focus on. Twitter was bought for a fairly high price. The price was agreed to before the tech bubble went down. And Elon Musk, who I've interviewed, is a very smart guy. He basically said he would buy the company, and he said he made a mistake in the documentation. He said he would buy it without any conditions, and he would basically go ahead with it. Well, as a result, when the prices went down and the market went down, he was still committed to pay the higher price. So the debt that was being raised, I think it was $13 billion of debt. The banks are holding this debt, but the value of the company is going down because of all the problems you read about, but also it was overpaid to begin with, I would say. So the banks had committed the $13 billion of debt. Now, when banks commit to debt, they take that seriously because if you borrow money from a bank, they take seriously that you're going to pay it back. So it doesn't look good if they make a commitment to somebody and that they don't honor it. So they're very good at honoring their commitments to lend money. So they honor their commitment to lend, it's like $13 billion. Maybe it's $11 billion. So that debt is now trading at, the banks haven't sold it yet, but it's worth 80 cents on the dollar. And maybe if it was actually traded, it'd probably be worth 60 cents on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar. So if you're a distressed debt investor and the banks ultimately sell that debt at 50 cents on a dollar, you would buy it thinking that ultimately Elon Musk is not going to let the company go bankrupt. And so the debt will eventually become par. But it's a bit of a risk. You don't know. But that's a good example of where the debt is probably going to be worth a lot less than par right away. But I suspect the company won't go bankrupt because he has enough money to kind of keep the thing going.
Sam Zell, the legendary real estate investor, is another of your subjects. His autobiography is titled, quote, Am I Being Too Subtle? Which is a tongue-in-cheek reference to his blunt style. Zell wins my heart because he went to a casual dress code in 1969 and never looked back, though he claims to own a few ties and admits to occasionally rearranging them. You broached the subject with him of, quote, how much research is enough? And the questions you have about the value of the 100-page investment memo you often see in these contexts. His comment was, quote, I don't call for 100-page investment memos because, number one, I'd be suspect if anybody could write a 100-page memo, and two, I'd be suspect of whether I could read it and not fall asleep. He said that in his opinion, a sufficient level of due diligence was a couple of days of a couple of smart people doing their homework. My question to you is, what's the right balance between gut instinct and exhaustive due diligence?
Well, you never know what the proper number is until the investment is over. Young MBAs in my firm, they'll prepare 300-400-page memo on the theory that the heavier the memo, the better the deal, I guess. And so they weigh you down with all the facts and statistics. But the truth is, Warren Buffett is not reading 300-page memos when he's making decisions. You have a certain gut, a certain experience, and certain sense of what makes sense and what doesn't. So I don't say you should do no due diligence. You should do due diligence. But I don't think you have to overcorrect by doing so much due diligence you don't see the forest for the trees. In Sam Zell's case, he's known as the grave dancer. because he likes to dance on the graves of other people's bad investments. And so, you know, you lost your money, he comes along and picks up the pieces, dances on your grave, and then he makes money from it. And he sold at the top of the market, the biggest real estate company in the United States, and he sold at the absolute top of the market and made a fortune doing that. Very smart person. He's 82 now, I think, and still racing motorcycles around the world. He's a great motorcycle racer and very smart, very clever guy. Trained as a lawyer like I am, but he never practiced a day in his life and didn't miss it either. He went to law school to please his mother, I think he said. But he's, you know, a contrarian and tells you exactly what he thinks. And very smart, clever guy, and so far it's worked out for him.
Your subject, Mark Andreessen, is famously the co-creator of the first widely used internet browser, Mosaic. How many of you folks used Mosaic, by the way? In a company he co-founded called Netscape. That was the very company that notably caused Bill Gates to pivot his entire company, Microsoft, to the internet. Andreessen, as I think most folks here know, is now perhaps the leading tech VC. Many tech recent VC valuations reached levels beyond anything we've seen in recent years, perhaps anything ever. Many of these have since declined precipitously. Some people, myself included, find it easy to understand the corrections, but hard to understand how these valuations got so stratospheric to begin with. How did that happen?
Well, it's human nature. Humans are always afraid that somebody's going to make a fortune and they didn't make it, so they tend to pile in when they see something good happening. It happens to the smartest people in the world. One of the smartest men who ever lived is thought to be Sir Isaac Newton, more or less the inventor of physics, among other things, and he invested in the South Sea Corporation many years ago, and he made a lot of money, and he sold his position. And then he kept the stock in the South Sea Corporation, kept going up and up and up. He said, wait a second, I'm not as smart as I thought. I left too much money on the table. And he got tired of hearing his neighbors saying, hey, I'm still in the South Sea Corporation. So he was jealous that his neighbors were still making money. So he mortgaged his house, put all his possessions for sale, and basically put all of his money back in the South Sea Corporation, which promptly went bankrupt. And so the smartest man in the world at the time went bankrupt because he couldn't stand the idea that his neighbors were making money on a company that he'd had before and he'd sold it too soon. So there's, you know, it's people tend to get, as the tulip bulb crisis in the Netherlands years centuries ago, people get carried away with things and, you know, people are afraid of missing out on something. So people tend to get into these waves and that you can't tell them that crypto really isn't worth exactly what they think it's worth, or Bitcoin might not be worth $50,000 of Bitcoin. It's hard to convince people of the, you know, irrationality of other humans at times. So I think we're always going to see these delusional things happening, and there's not much you can convince people about it because they, until they lose, they're not really going to take the lesson. But how do the tech prices get so high? Well, think about this. How many of you today can get through a day without using either Apple, Zoom, Microsoft products, Amazon, Facebook, or Google? So those companies were not around more or less in the late 1980s. They weren't around really in the mid, some of them were, but basically in the part of this century we're now in, we're 22 years into the century, these become ubiquitous. You can't get along without these things that these companies make. And as a result, people have said technology is taking over the world. It's eating everything else. So if you see new technology companies, everybody wants to get into the next new technology. I wasn't prescient enough to understand this at the time. I didn't make the great investments, but I'll tell you, when Mark Andreessen was, he was at college at University of Illinois, he invented Mosaic, which basically is a way to navigate the internet. He came to my office with somebody else who had been a CEO of Silicon Graphics, and he said, look, this young college kid who was wearing long hair, he had jeans on, sandals, was in my office. He said, we are going to build a company that's going to help people navigate the internet. And I said, well, what is the internet and why would I want to navigate it? I didn't know. Nobody knew what it was. So, and Bill Gates, when he wrote his first book, never mentioned the word internet in the first book. He never had the word internet in there because it wasn't thought to be anything. So we looked at Mark Andreessen and we said, this college kid has got a company that's going to be worth, they wanted us to invest at a valuation of about $175 million. We said, look, we're pretty smart. You have no revenue, you have no earnings, you have no staff, you have nothing. Why would we pay $175 million valuation? So they came back a little bit later for $125 million. We turned it down again. Later it was sold to AOL for $4.25 billion, I think. So we made mistakes. And, you know, I wasn't prescient enough when Mark Zuckerberg was starting Facebook. My now son-in-law was his classmate at Harvard and at Phillips Exeter. And my son-in-law, knowing that I was in the investment business, now my son-in-law, he said to me, you know, my classmate is starting this company. It's called Facebook, and it helps people get dates at Harvard, and they're going to expand it to Yale and Princeton. I said, look, I'm pretty experienced. These dating companies, they don't really work after a while. I've been that. So I had a chance to put, I think, $30,000 in when Mark was in college. Today was worth $1.13 billion. So I made a lot of my mistakes, and I wasn't smart enough. And like Jeff Bezos, when Jeff Bezos was starting his company, it was going to sell books over the Internet. Now, nobody even, many people didn't know what the Internet was, and why would you sell books over the Internet? So we owned a company at Carlyle that was the second biggest book distributor in the United States called Baker & Taylor. It had been started in 1854, had not made a profit since 1854, never profitable. We bought it from W.R. Grace, and apparently a salesman was approached by Jeff Bezos saying, I'm going to sell books over the Internet. I need a bibliography of books over the Internet, and Baker & Taylor had the biggest bibliography in the country. So he said, I don't have a lot of money. I'll give you 25% of this company I'm starting in return for letting me use the bibliography. And our smart salesman said, no, we want cash. So we'll take $100,000 a year for 5 years. So after I didn't hear about it directly, but then I read about a company that was going to start books over the Internet. I read it in the newspaper. It was a company called Amazon. And I said, they're going to sell books over the Internet. They must need a bibliography. I said, there might be another idiot who will pay us $100,000 a year for 5 years to rent our bibliography. He said, no, that's the idiot that we already got. So I went out to see Jeff Bezos after I read that was actually doing pretty well. And I went to his ramshackle office building, a tiny, tiny office building. And he basically, the way it worked, and if you want a book over the Internet, you send him your email. And then he would send his email to the publisher. Publisher would send the book to him. He'd then repackage it with his email. And every night, he'd take it to the post office and deposit sometimes 20 books a day, sometimes 30 books a day. It was nothing. So I went out to see him and said, look, I think you probably might have something here. I don't think I want that $100,000 a year anymore. I'll take the 25% of the company. He said, David, that was 2 years ago. I'm advanced a little bit now. I'll give you 1% of the company in return for the deal. I said, okay. So I took 1% of the company, and as soon as the company went public, I sold it because, you know, I didn't think it was going to get anywhere. But, okay, that was life. We made a mistake. But, you know, today we have the opposite. Anytime somebody, a college kid can show up in your office today and he or she looks like they, you know, basically just got out of bed in the morning. They don't know anything. And they look like Sam Bankman-Fried. And all of a sudden, he's going to start in there, or she's going to start a new company, and you say, this is going to be next Facebook. So people get caught up in these stories, and everybody thinks they're going to discover the next Facebook or something. It's not easy to do, but the tech values, you know, they're not going to go away for a while because we're so dependent on technology, and people always think that one of these new technology companies will be the next Google, next Facebook, something like that. So it's kind of hope springs eternal with some of these companies. I did interview Sam Bankman-Fried. If anybody see my show, you know, I wore dressing like I always do. This was my casual kind of dress. And he showed up with the tennis shoes and tennis socks and shorts and the little T-shirt. And, I said, okay, this guy, and his hair was a little unruly. This guy really must be really smart. I can't understand anything he's saying. You're really smart. So sometimes you have to be careful.
By the way, I happen to know the Sir Isaac Newton story has a happy ending. He met a young man named David Rubenstein, put the rest of his money in a Carlyle fund,
and
sailed off into the sunset. In your interview with Ki Lu, CEO of Columbia's investment management company, she talked about her own experience as a poor student entering the world of the University of Pennsylvania and contrasted it with the experience of a poor student entering an Ivy League school today. She then said something I found surprising, saying, quote, it is much more challenging for students who come from poor backgrounds now than when I was there because the wealth is conspicuous now in a way that it wasn't the case back then. What do you think she's referring to?
Okay. Well, for those who don't know, Kim Lu had an unusual background, you could argue. Her father was 17 years old. He was an African-American. Her mother was Chinese, 17 years old. They met and got married at 17 each, and they had a child who was obviously half African-American, half Chinese. The parents were not thrilled on either side, and so they kind of disowned their grandchild and didn't really talk to their children very much. She grew up in a, you know, setting her parents, gave her a good education. She went to University of Pennsylvania and later Harvard Business School. When she went to Penn, the students that went to Penn were, they were not conspicuously wealthy in those days. So, in other words, they didn't all have their own Porsches or BMWs or something, and they weren't flashing their money. And today, there's real bifurcation at these a lot of schools, and I'm involved with a number of them, so I see it. You get some very wealthy people, and they give their kids a lot of money, and the kids have great cars and great vacations and great clothes, and then you have people who are on financial aid, and they don't often have that. And one of the problems with the schools these days is you can accept a lot of people who are from poor backgrounds. Like when I went to college, I had no money at all. My father worked in the post office. We had nothing. So I got a scholarship to go to Duke. But getting a scholarship isn't really make you feel like you're part of the class, because when your friends are going off to Bermuda for the weekend or your friends have a car to take you to take them to a restaurant, you're sort of stuck behind. So it's one thing to get in and get financial aid to pay the tuition and the room and board. It's another thing to actually feel part of a class. And so a lot of really good colleges now are giving additional capital or stipends to poor kids who they can feel like they're really part of the environment. Not that they're trying to be the wealthiest ones, but they feel like they're really more part of it than they would have otherwise been. So what she was referring to is that she didn't really feel so out of place because there wasn't such conspicuous wealth then. Today she thinks there's conspicuous wealth. She manages the endowment now for Columbia University.
So we're going to let the audience ask some questions. So you folks kind of get your questions together, but I get one more before we do. Your crypto interview is with the leading crypto investor, Mike Novogratz, at a point just before the precipitous crypto implosion we now see. Have you touched base with him since then? How's he holding up? What the heck happened in the crypto market?
Well, that'll take a couple days or maybe a couple years to describe. But basically, Mike Novogratz, if you don't know, grew up in Maryland, or Virginia. I was an all-star wrestler, went to Princeton, all-Ivy wrestler, but always kind of trying different things. He went to Goldman, became very good at trading, started Fortress, became very good at trading, but he kind of picked up the idea of crypto and built a company which is a large crypto owner, and he had at one point when I interviewed him about $9 billion personally of crypto value. I think he paid, maybe $100 million for it, and it was worth $9 billion. So I haven't checked on what the $9 billion is now worth, but let's suppose it's worth $2 billion. Well, if you put $100 million and you got $2 billion, still better than nothing. And so he's probably doing okay, I would say. But I think crypto is a thing where everybody's afraid of missing the next best thing, the next big thing. Everybody's afraid you're going to miss Google, Facebook. So when crypto came along, the same kind of people that were pushing the internet, smartphones, computers, were young people. Young people are the ones that start these trends. You don't get people who are 75 years old starting companies that people think are going to be the next great thing. You get people in their 20s, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, the Google guys, they were all in their 20s more or less when they started these companies. So if somebody comes along and young people are all excited about crypto, I can see why people might say, well, maybe I will get interested in it. And then, of course, crypto went up for a while. A lot of people were making fortunes on it. There's a famous statement that when Joe Kennedy, the famous President Kennedy's father, was one of the wealthiest men in the country. One day he went to get a shoe shine, 1929, and on Wall Street, and the shoe shine guy was saying, hey, what do you think of the stock market? And some of my stocks are not doing so well. That's when Joe Kennedy thought the market's topped out, when the shoe shine guy is talking about stocks. Well, today, sometimes when I'm on TV, the cameraman comes up to me and says, my crypto stocks are really going down today. I kind of, what is the cameraman doing buying crypto? So I get a little nervous about it from time to time, about everybody's in crypto. But I tell people, look, if you go to Las Vegas and you if you're smart, you'll know you're going to lose money. If you win money the first day, you're going to give it back the second day. If you make money for 2 days, you'll give it back the third day. Eventually, you're going to lose everything. Eventually. That's the way the odds work in Las Vegas. So if you say, look, I get pleasure out of gambling and I'm allocating $10,000 to do it, fine. So take the same amount of money you're allocating for pleasure in Las Vegas, put it in crypto, and when you lose it, you'll have the same pleasure if you enjoy watching things go up and down. I think crypto is not going to go away, in part because young people like it, and young people still are going to be buying this for a while. They're not going to be deterred by Sam Bankman-Fried. There are other companies out there. Secondly, let's suppose you're a wealthy Chinese person, and you see what happened to the Russian oligarchs. All their assets are taken, to the extent you can find them. And let's suppose you're a wealthy Chinese businessman or woman in the United States, and you're afraid that if China invades Taiwan, there's going to be recriminations against Chinese business people. Maybe that won't happen, but you might be afraid of it. So you want to have some of your assets in something that nobody can theoretically touch. It's nobody knows you have it. No tax authority knows you have it. You can move it across borders and so forth. And I suspect there are a lot of people around the world who may have not the best purposes in mind who are going to want to keep this going for a while. So I wouldn't say it's a complete and total fraud in the sense that there's no value at all in having something like this. But I would say it's probably not something for the faint of heart. And you really should be prepared to lose it all if you're going to put it in. Now, I have not bought any cryptocurrencies. I have invested in a few companies that service the industry, but these are companies that are doing pretty well because of the way they're doing. My company, my family office did look at FTX as an investment, and my guys said, hey, we can't figure out what FTX relationship is with Alameda. We can't figure out, and we can't get any good answers. So they turned it down. So I wish I could take credit for turning it down, but they did. So I think there were a lot of people who did due diligence, got nervous about it. Not everybody did. But anyway, I just also wanted to say to people, for the average person, and that's what I say in the book, the average person should not try to be anybody who's an expert in this book. It's not going to happen. You have to devote your life to doing this. If you're a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer, great, you're doing great things for society, fine. Or a public official, great things for society. Don't try to be Warren Buffett. That's not realistic. You have to devote your life to these subjects and really know what you're doing. So the best thing to do on average for most people is to go into some kind of fund. I would say an index fund, a stock index fund, or a money market index fund, or fixed income, because you're not going to beat the averages in the end. And if you do one year, you'll convince yourself you're great and you'll lose some money the next year. So on the average, for the best person, go buy a Vanguard fund or a Blackguard fund, a BlackRock fund, because those are probably reasonably safe. They'll do the market averages. And so what I'm trying to tell the average person is that I have in the book things you should do when you're looking at funds, the kind of standards you should look at and what you should judge the fund standards to be. Don't try to be a great investor if you're going to do it part-time. If you're going to do it full-time and you want to make it your profession, that's fine, but make sure you know what you're doing and do a lot of the research and reading. And you can't read too much about the investments you're making. It is amazing to me that doctors or lawyers or others, they do all the due diligence and they do all this work on their profession, but when they invest their money, they don't pay much attention to where the money's going and they don't really know the details. You really have to learn what you're doing if you're going to put money into something other than an index fund. Even index funds, you got to make sure you know what the fees are and the rules are and so forth. So I'd like everybody here to be Warren Buffett, but I have to be realistic about it. You and I are not going to be Warren Buffett. It's too complicated. But that doesn't mean you can't get good investment returns by going to reasonably good funds that are risk appropriate.
Who has a question for David?
Actually, I was going to ask you about health care, because in the Barron's interview yesterday, you cited that health care is probably the most interesting area of investment. I have a granddaughter who's living in Paris, and I asked her over Thanksgiving, why would you rather live in France than in the United States? She said quickly, health care. Because in France, we have universal health care. I don't have to worry about where I work. I'm automatically covered as a citizen. What do you see as the prospect for the United States expanding its health care coverage, whether it's in terms of expanded Medicare or whether you see opportunities that take advantage of the inefficiency that's in our health care system?
Well, let me just say why I think healthcare is a pretty good investment area. When I worked in the White House for Jimmy Carter in the late 1970s, healthcare was 7% of the GDP of the United States. Today, it's roughly 21 or 22%. So we're spending three times as much, relatively speaking, on healthcare. Why is that? Well, the population is aging, and while that's generally a good thing, it does cost more for medical treatments. Any of you who are over the age of 50 or 60 know that you probably spend more time with doctors than you did when you were, let's say, 30 years old. So that's a general rule of thumb. And so people increasingly, as they live longer, they're going to spend more on health care. Secondly, As people get wealthier, and our country is getting fairly wealthy, increasingly more and more people, not everybody, but more and more people, when people get wealthier, they say, hey, I've got a good thing going here, I'm going to live longer. So I'm going to have more time on healthcare. I'm going to eat less, I'm going to drink less, I'm going to do things that are make me healthier. And so increasingly, as people get wealthier, they want to spend more money on healthcare. And around the world, as countries that were poverty-stricken before get wealthier, like China, the same phenomenon. People in China are spending fortunes now on healthcare because they now can afford to do it, and they now realize that life can be pretty good. And so that's why I think it's probably a pretty good area of growth. On your question of universal healthcare, in effect, getting Obamacare through, so-called, only passed the Congress by one vote in the House. I don't know whether Obamacare could pass today because, you know, complicated things or not, but I think getting universal health care, I think it's going to be too complicated in my lifetime to see it pass. So around the margins, they might give you additional, some Medicare benefits here or there, but nothing like universal health care, I think, is likely to pass in this country anytime soon. And your daughter is, your daughter, you're saying? Granddaughter. That's a smart thing to do. I have my own way of dealing with health care. Fortunately, I'm reasonably healthy, but, you know, as I get older, you know, things will start going down. And I generally live my life in what I call sprinting to the finish line principle, trying to get as much done before the brain collapses or the body collapses. And inevitably, one of these things is going to collapse. You know, when I was growing up, my parents always used to read the obituary pages. And I said, why are you reading that? They said, well, I'm going to see who died and maybe know. Well, now I read the obituaries all the time. See, how come somebody younger than me died and I'm still around? So, but my health care program is to be on hospital boards. If you can be on the board of a hospital, here's what happens. When you call up, they have a person who handles the board members' inquiries. So if a friend calls me and says, I'm on the Sloan Kettering board, I need to go see the oncologist on pancreatic cancer. Well, I can call up and call and say, look, a friend of mine wants to see somebody. I'm on the board. I've given some money. You get to see them right away. How many people here ever heard from doctors who say, I'll see you in 30 days, 60 days? Well, you know, on the healthcare, if you're my healthcare insurance program is to be on hospital boards, because if I ever need anything, I can get in to see them. That's what I try to do. But anyway, I don't know if everybody can do that.
Secrets from the world of investing. Right. Who else has a question?
I have a question about choosing financial advisors. I'm 90 years old. I never heard of some of these outfits that you're talking about that are making 40, 60%. What's the impetus of these financial advisors? Are they in it just to make the money, or some of them more serious, concerned about their clients?
All right. Well, the 40% a year or so is what Jim Simons, who's the single best quantitative investor in the history of the world, is making on a special fund called the Medallion Fund, which is only for employees, more or less. So we don't really know how they do it, but that's what he's been averaging. But, you know, there's always going to be somebody the best in the world, and that's the best in the world. The average... They used to call them stockbrokers. Now they call them registered investment advisors, RIAs. And, you know, they obviously have an incentive to get you to buy something. That's inevitable. But I think they're pretty reasonable, because they recognize if their reputation for putting in bad things, it gets around, then they're not going to have clients. And clearly they get paid more fees in certain things than others. But in the end, I think most registered investment advisors want to get clients that are happy. And clients that are happy are going to be ones that get reasonable rates of return. If somebody is promising you 40% rates of return, you should run away as soon as possible. There's no way anybody can consistently do that and legally do it. I think over the last 100 years, a stock market averages more or less 6% a year in the United States, more or less, not counting inflation. And fixed income averages over the last 100 years more or less 2.5% to 3%. So that's the kind of bar that you have, you know, 2.5% or 3% if you're dealing with fixed income, 6% if you're dealing with public equities. Private equity or alternative, so-called, are going to get you something in the mid-teen range overall. If somebody's promising you much more than that, you should be very leery. But again, you should, you know, if you're picking a fund manager, this is what you should do. When you pick a fund manager, look at the track record. That's the best indicator of their future performance. Make sure the people that produce that track record are still there. Make sure the people who you're investing with are putting a large percentage of their own money alongside you. Make sure they haven't been sued for fraud or other kinds of things on a consistent basis. Make sure young people aren't leaving the organization because they're not a happy place to work. Make certain that there's an organization where you can understand what the fees are. They're intelligible. Make sure you can get access to how the performance is on a regular basis. And make certain that other people that you know are investing. You know, smart money knows how to find good deals and good funds. And if you ask who's investing in this fund aside from you and they won't tell you, go somewhere else. But, you know, to be realistic in your expectations, an important rule. The key rules are, if you're investing overall, is don't put all your eggs in one basket. Have realistic expectations of rates of return. You know, you should have realistic recommendations or expectations. I would say, for example, you're on the board of PSERS, right? Okay. So PSERS is like any other big public pension fund. On average, all the sovereign wealth funds in the world, all the public pension funds in the world, they're all trying to get more or less 6%, 7%, maybe 6% rates of return on everything they manage. Everything, 6%. With fixed income, private equity, they averaged out to 6%. Their private equity will be better than that. Their fixed income will be lower than that. But 6% is probably not a bad number to kind of expect your investment performance to be overall for if you have a kind of a modulated investment portfolio of stocks, bonds, private equity, 6, 7, 8%, it'd be pretty good generally.
First, you should be commended. Many of us have role models that set examples and standards for us to follow. You're a very humble, self-deprecating, extremely successful person, and I think a lot of people draw on you as an example. You should be commended for that. Not too long in the future, there'll be vaccines to address practically every disease.
Right.
Okay. And there may be a better environment for people to accept vaccines in light of the fact that the whole world just had to adjust to a generally non-life-threatening condition and take a vaccine to get back to life.
Right.
Where is Wall Street? Where do you see us right now at this precipice
on vaccines?
Vaccines. And how it's going to impact healthcare?
Obviously, President Trump, and I interviewed President Trump once. He's a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania. I think everybody knows. I don't know if he was summa cum laude, but I don't think so. I interviewed him once. What actually happened is I didn't really know him, but my parents, who were blue-collar workers when they retired at the age of 55, when they could retire from the Postal Service, they moved to a suburb of Baltimore called West Palm Beach, Florida. And when they moved down there, I would go down and have events down there from time to time for anniversaries or graduations, and I would always do it at Mar-a-Lago because you didn't have to be a member. You just show up with a credit card. They're happy to have you. There's one guy who always show up with orange hair, kind of wanted to be in our photos, and he was like photobombing all our family events, and eventually I figured out it was Donald Trump. He told me he was Donald Trump. So one time I was looking for a speaker at the Economic Club of Washington. I'm the president of it. And I have to get speakers all the time, and somebody I can interview. So one time somebody said, what about Donald Trump? I said, well, he's not that successful a real estate guy, is he? They said, no, but he's got a great TV show, and people will show up. So I invited him, and 5 minutes later, he scrawled back in a little fax thing saying he'll be there. Came down, this was in 2015, and he said, David, ask me anything you want in the interview, except ask me two questions for certain. One, ask me if I'm going to run for president. I said, president of what? He said, president of the United States. I said, Donald, that's ridiculous. He said, I know, but it'll help my brand because I'll do it for a couple months and people will know me better. What's your other question? Ask me if my hair is real and you pull the hair and show people they think it's fake. I said, geez, I'm not comfortable pulling your hair, but I'll ask you about it. So I had the interview. The only thing I stumped him on, I said, Donald, you ever had any self-doubt? He said, what do you mean? What is that? Self-doubt? I don't know. He didn't have any. You know, I think he knew what I was talking about. So then the next day he called me and said, David, it's the best interview I ever had. I'm going to make you an honorary member of Mar-a-Lago, which he did, since rescinded. And he said, you know, it's the highest rated show in the history of C-SPAN. Highest rated show. And so I called the president of C-SPAN. I said, what were the ratings for that interview? He said, we don't have ratings, so nobody can know. So then I realized sometimes maybe exaggerates. Anyway, on vaccines, I think, vaccines, it's a medical miracle what happened. A vaccine usually takes a long time to develop. The polio vaccine took 7 years plus to develop. No vaccine had ever been developed in less than 4 years. This vaccine was developed in roughly 11 months. It's an incredible miracle that happened, and for a lot of reasons I can explain how it happened, but it's incredible. But we politicized the vaccine, and the result was that roughly 35% of Americans refused to take it, 35%. 99% of Americans taking the polio vaccine. No, there was no controversy about that. And there are some vaccines that people were not happy as much with. There are some people that think that autism is caused by childhood vaccines. There's no history of that, no real reason to think that's true, but some people believe that. But we politicize it, and as a result, we have a real problem now. I think when another pandemic comes along, as it inevitably will, and we develop another vaccine, it's inevitable that people will not want to take it for the same reason. They're worried about it, and the politics of it's complicated. So I do worry that we have politicized healthcare a bit, and vaccines have been unduly politicized, but not only in this country. In other countries, a large percentage of people also are not taking them, much more than I would have thought would be the case. In polio vaccine, 99% take it. This vaccine, a much smaller percentage. I think there will ultimately be a vaccine for all kinds of other things. But think about this. We don't have a vaccine today for AIDS or HIV. If you have HIV, you can take a pill and you probably won't get AIDS, but we don't have a vaccine yet that will prevent you from getting HIV. And we've been working on this for 25 years, so it's not that easy to develop these vaccines. That's why it's a miracle that we got one for the coronavirus. So your question was, do I think there's going to be a vaccine for everything, or?
Just about. If you know by taking a genetic test that you're predisposed to breast
yes.
cancer or prostate cancer,
yes.
and there's a vaccine to help you prevent that from happening, that's where
I think that will happen at some point. I mean, there's a problem. For example, if you take a 23andMe test and you do all the things and you know you have a predisposition to Alzheimer's, do you really want to know? James Watson, who discovered DNA, co-discovered it with Francis Crick, he told me he was the first human who had his genome completely mapped. But he told me that he told the people doing it not to tell him if he had a predisposition for Alzheimer's, because what is he going to do about it? So how many people here, if they would like to know if they have a predisposition to Alzheimer's? Anybody want to know? Oh, one? Okay. Two? You know, I don't know if I'd want to know, because I don't know what would I do about it. And right now there's nothing you can do about it that I know of. Except, you can learn how to play a musical instrument, you can do crossword puzzles, but I don't know if that really works. And there's some things people say you can do, but I think it may be genetically difficult to overcome. So,
by the way, the commercial here is that the technology for these vaccines was developed here at University of
right.
Pennsylvania by Drew
yeah.
Weissman and Katie Carrico,
right.
who are already working on the next 5 or 10 vaccines,
right.
many of which for common diseases. We have time for one more
okay.
question.
I just say on a vaccine or on Alzheimer's, the test really should be this. If you're carrying around your key here and you're looking for your key, that's not Alzheimer's. If you open your refrigerator and the key's in the refrigerator, that's Alzheimer's.
Now we know.
I was curious about if there was something that you thought going into having these conversations that you were expecting to be a quality of that made someone stand out in investing that you didn't see, or what was the thing that was maybe
yeah.
most surprising?
I couldn't really hear the question. What was the question?
Was there a characteristic you expected a great investor to have that you didn't see?
And was there, what was the thing that surprised you?
I expected
you
them to be cockier and more arrogant. Maybe I didn't interview all the arrogant ones, but I do think that humility was a bigger quality than I expected, because when you are an investor, you're making mistakes almost every day. And therefore, you kind of learn some humility. And therefore, but I didn't realize that. I thought that these people, because they made so much money, they were so smart, they would be very arrogant. But actually, they were not. They're pretty humble, because they realize every day they're going to make a mistake, and every day they know they've done something wrong. They've lost some money. Well, not every day, but relatively frequently. So I didn't see the arrogance that I expected to see.
David, it is a true honor for us to have you here.
Thank you.
David needs the money, so buy the book.
It's all going to children's hospitals.
It's all going to children's hospitals. Buy the book. Thank you for coming. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.